This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
You're listening to 90.7 FM KBOO in Portland. My name is Natalie Marie, and this is Out Loud Radio. We've got a really great show for you lined up tonight. Q-Doc is back in the studio once again. We told you we'd bring them back for an update, and so I will be talking tonight with David Weissman and also director Marta Cunningham of the show Valentine Road, of the documentary Valentine Road. But before we get into that, I just want to remind listeners out there that you can get involved with community radio, Out Loud Radio. This is a community station. It's a community-run program, and the best way to do that, if you hear something you like or you hear something you don't like or you just want to get involved with doing radio, is to come down to the studio, come down to KBOO, get in contact with us at outloudradio@gmail.com. Look us up on Facebook. You can always get involved, and we always need help, and we always need volunteers. It's all free. You come down, you get the training, you can start making radio, get on here, and basically talk about whatever you want. But today we're talking about queer culture and Q-Doc, which is the Portland Queer Documentary Film Festival. In the studio, I have David Weissman with me. And on the line is Marta Cunningham. Not quite yet. Marta's not quite there yet, but she will be on the line very shortly. And we're going to talk to Marta about her show as well. But since I have you here, David, welcome. Welcome back to the show. Welcome back to Out Loud.
It's always fun to be at KBOO.
It is. Yeah. We try to make it as fun as possible without getting out of control, too out of control. But yeah, since you were on a couple weeks ago, mm-hmm. With Carla talking a little bit about Q-Doc. And why don't you give us like a little bit of recap for people that didn't hear that show, and tell us a little bit about Q-Doc and what's going on this week.
Well, I'm always surprised that there's people in Portland who don't know about Q-Doc, so right. It's always good to sort of give an overview of what the festival is. We started it 7 years ago. This is our seventh festival. It was started by myself and Russ Gage. We're both former San Franciscans, and Russ had this very unusual idea to have a festival that was exclusively donated to LGBT documentaries, and they're isn't any other one in the entire world. There was one in Australia. I'm not sure if it still exists or not. So it's a really unique thing, and it's wonderful, I think, for audiences, and it's also great for the filmmakers because documentaries really get full attention here in a way that they don't in other festivals. So it's a four-day festival, and we show what we consider to be the best queer documentaries that have come out in the previous year. And we try to bring as many of the filmmakers as we can to the festival so that they can have conversations with the audience. And we try to make it fun and challenging and stimulating and provocative and, you know, everything you want out of going to the movies. And sexy.
And sexy, too.
And sexy.
That's important, too. So tell me a little bit about the what kind of shows we're going to be what kind of documentaries we're going to be seeing this year.
Well, what's exciting about a festival like this, and I mean, it's part of our curatorial intention, is mm-hmm. to have a huge range of movies. We have films that deal with historical subjects. We have films that deal with contemporary issues. We have films that are domestic, that are international, that deal with the whole gender spectrum. And it's a huge range of movies. We have films about queer artists, and we have films about lesbian history, and it's a huge range, and to some degree, we never know exactly what the range is going to be until we know what's been made over the course of the year. So we're always sort of, you know, in January when the year starts, we're like, well, what's out there? And then we kind of try to look at a variety of things and then piece together a program that has a real diverse quality to it. So it's a fun thing to put together.
So different aspects.
Yeah.
And trying to represent the, I guess, the different spectrums, as
yeah.
you could say, of the rainbow. Wonderful. That's cool. So tell me about tickets. Tell me about how do people get to it? Where's it at?
Our program is in cafes all over town, but it's very easy to get online at our website, which is queerdocfest.org. And if you forget that, just go to Q-Doc, just go to Portland Queer Documentary on Google, and we'll pop up very quickly. And all of our films are listed there. Tickets are $10 for everything. We have an opening night reception that is that's already sold out.
Oh.
But we also have, and I want to really I want to emphasize this, we have free tickets for youth 23 and under, so which is supported by the Equity Foundation, and we're really, really thrilled to be able to do that. So if people go to the website, there's a link there, and they need to, you know, book them in advance, but there are free tickets for anyone 23 and under for each of the films at the QDOC Festival, so we really want to encourage young people to come and take advantage of that.
Definitely. Wonderful. You hear that, kids? So Smirk, Living Room, all you LGBTQ youths out there, get your free tickets. This is a free movie. I mean, come on.
Come on down.
Come on down. That's it. So, yeah, and you said opening night's already sold out.
No, just the reception.
Just the reception.
Just the pre-film reception.
Okay.
For the first time, our opening night is at the Baghdad, which is the biggest venue we've ever been in.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, not only is it big, it's glamorous. And, you know, so, and we're really excited. And the reason it's in such a big, glamorous venue is because we have a big, glamorous subject of the movie, which is the famous star of the early John Waters films, Divine.
Tell me about this.
A movie called I Am Divine, and it just came out, and it just premiered in South by Southwest, and it is the definitive documentary about Divine and that whole wacky crowd of performers that John Waters assembled in Baltimore all those years ago to make movies that to this day remain the most outrageous movies ever made.
Right.
Pink Flamingos, Female Trouble, Polyester, Hairspray, all of those movies. And not only do we have the movie about Divine, we also have Divine's co-star in most of those movies, Mink Stoll, who will be coming to join us here in Portland for the opening night, along with the director, Jeffrey Schwartz. So it's like going to be a big – I have a feeling people are going to get, you know, dressed up for the event.
Yes.
So it should be – we're really excited about being at the Baghdad for opening night. And then we go back to the Kennedy School, which is where the festival was last year for the next 3 days of films, which it was a great venue for us.
Yeah, wonderful. Okay, awesome. Yeah, the Baghdad, that's huge. That's great.
And it's 3 blocks from my house, so I get to stumble over and stumble home.
I can't think of a more appropriate venue, actually, for that. Okay, and actually, now we have, I think I've got Marta on the line. Are you there, Marta?
I am. I'm here.
Hi, welcome to the show, Marta.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, Marta. Looking forward to meeting you when you get here. This is David.
I know. It's going to be, I'm just listening going, I'm going to have so much fun.
I
love John Waters. I'm so excited for Jeffrey Schwartz's film.
Yeah.
It's going to be a great week and a great weekend. We're talking a little bit about some of the shows that are going to be some of the documentaries that are going to be, showing. I Am Divine, of course, was opening night.
Right, and Marta's film, Valentine Road, is our closing night film. It's an HBO film, which we're very excited that HBO is allowing us to show prior to their broadcast of it, which will be in the fall sometime. So we're really thrilled to have a movie like this for our closing night film. It's a very, very, very powerful documentary that had its premiere at Sundance.
I agree. I saw a few clips of it and a few moments of it. Let me ask you, Marta, a little bit about the film. Would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about what's the film about?
Well, you know, it's a hard film to kind of sum up, but I think the best way for me to do that is that it's about two boys. It's about Brandon McInerney and Lawrence King. Lawrence King was an out biracial transgender youth who the last 2 weeks of his life was experimenting and decided that he would rather wear barrettes and makeup and some heels on his boots. And he was shot and killed by Brandon McInerney in eighth grade in the classroom in Oxnard. And the film looks at the incident, but it also goes beyond that. And it looks at what happens to a community, to a school, to the children in that classroom after an incident like this. Because there's so many different aspects to it. I also decided to look at Brandon so we can also study and look at people who feel this way. Yes, he was 14 at the time, but he did something just so inconceivable. And I wanted to get to the bottom of why people do things in this nature, why hate crimes like this exist. And I really started looking at the juvenile justice system as well, because what they decided to do is try Brandon as an adult at 14 years old, and he was looking at 53 years to life without the chance of parole. So it also takes you through that trial. So you start to understand who Brandon is, and you I hope, fall in love with Larry, because I did, and because of the confidence that he had to really be himself at such a young age and to know himself, really was just so powerful to me and so courageous that I felt like I wanted to make sure he had a voice.
Well, definitely. And what I've seen of the film so far is it's definitely what you've spoke to. It's very powerful, very moving, and definitely something that's, you know, that we need to explore, I think, or that people need to explore a little bit more, is why these things happen, or why do they still happen? Would you say...
And how can we stop it? I mean, we're adults. We're the adults in the equation. How do we teach our children to not have this festering hatred for difference?
Right. I mean, where does that come from?
It's a real problem in our culture. And it was really, I mean, I have children, and I just felt like, what if one of my children was Larry? This is acceptable? You know, we're going to blame the victim? No. I mean, it was just abhorrent what I saw. And during the trial, what I saw in the media coverage, I was just, we have to do this doc. It was like a calling for me that a child was being blamed for his own murder.
Marta, I had heard about the film right after Sundance from friends of mine who were there, and it, you know, people were really raving about it. And what struck me so much when we screened it to consider it for QDoc was how understated it is. It's so compassionate. It's not sensational in the least. I mean, it's a subject matter that's, you know, so ripe for sensationalism, and it's such a compassionate, complex inquiry into this whole issue, and I mean, it just knocked both Russ and me out when we watched it because of that. It's a beautiful and sensitive and thoughtful film about a very painful subject and very intelligent film.
Thank you so much. I just really was so angered by the media coverage. And I just couldn't believe that it was just going to be, at that time, you know, this was before Newtown. So at that time, for some reason, there was a tremendous amount of apathy about school shootings. It was just kind of like, oh, you know, how kids are, and, well, you know, these schools are so violent. Like, wait a second, I'm sorry. Have we really gotten to a place now where we've just accepted children shooting each other in schools or in our communities? It's too much. And it just upset me to a level where I just felt like I had to do a documentary about it. And I also sat in the hearings and the trial every day for Brandon and started seeing, you know, the human being that he was, and the fact that he was not a monster. And if we keep making people monsters, then we're never going to get to the bottom, and we're never going to find a solution. We can't keep making people monsters. There's no solution in that. I mean, we can, but then we're just going to keep repeating this problem, this issue, and that we're all responsible for. That was really something that I felt clear about as I was making this film, talking to the kids who were so lost, and just trying to have anyone listen to them. And they really knew exactly, I think, since you've seen the movie, you know, you see that the kids really seem to be on the ball, and they really seem to get it. And it was really the adults who were just kind of stumbling around in the dark.
Marta, have you shown the film in the Oxnard community at all yet? Have the locals seen it?
You know, we haven't done that yet, and I'm not sure if we're going to. I know that our air date is now fast approaching in October, or at least in the fall. So I think we have shown it to a few people, but it's such a disturbing, upsetting incident that happened. A lot of people are like, I don't want to talk about it anymore. I don't want to look at that anymore. So, you know, we're hoping that we can get to them and let them know when it's showing on HBO so that they will watch it.
Well, it's interesting that what you brought up. I mean, because I think, you know, some people may watch it in 10 years.
Exactly.
You know, people need to be ready to revisit traumas, and some people never are, and some people, you know, will be ready to immediately, and some people will at a certain point in time. I mean, I know that with my own film, with We Were Here, it was very much a similar thing.
Yes. Yeah. It's important to give, you know, the space. And I, you know, the kids, of course, they're young adults now, but they were kids when I started, and they were immediately like, when is it coming out? When can we see it? And I'm like, wait, hold on a second. I don't quite think you understand what you're going to be watching, you know. To them, it was just still kind of a film or a movie. And I'm in it. And I'm like, yeah, but it's about what you went through. And so I made sure that one of the young adults that's in the film, Mariah, she had her friends with her, she had her therapist with her, and, you know, we all sat and talked about it for a couple hours after she viewed it. So it needs to be a very nurturing environment when the people in the film see it, and they need to make sure that they're in the right headspace for it, no doubt.
Definitely. I just wanted to ask, you spoke a little bit about, I guess, what inspired you, but I guess more specifically, what inspired you to make a documentary about this particularly? It was with the youth. It was something that personally affected you. You said you've got children, so.
I do, and I'm biracial, mm-hmm. and I think, you know, Larry, I just connected with him on a very real level. I just felt like he could have been my younger brother. I don't know how to explain it. It was just something that happens sometimes for people that watch the film. You just have a connection with this kid. Mm-hmm. He's just so incredible. And as an adult, you see it. You know, when you're a child and you're next to someone who decided to call himself Letitia in eighth grade and he's deciding to wear makeup and you're like, whoa, what's going on? You know, it's completely understandable that some of the children that now regret how they treated him are in this space now of wow, I can't believe I didn't accept him for who he was. He was so strong. He was so confident. I mean, one of the kids comes out the day of the shooting because she realizes the power that he had in being himself. But I look back and I remember, you know, growing up in the Bay Area, which was very liberal, but it was still, you know, I was still in suburbia. And I remember the kids who were gay, who at that time, we didn't even use that word. It was like, well, no one said it, but it was an understood thing. Right. And I just think about Larry really now in this small town with very small-minded adults around him going, you know what, this is who I am. And this is, I want you to call me Letitia. And this is what I'm comfortable wearing. And this is what I'm comfortable being. So I don't really care how you feel about it. I'm happy. I just think that person, anyone like that, should be celebrated.
Right. Talk about courageous.
I just felt like he wasn't being celebrated in any form, any written form, any news coverage that I really saw. It just didn't get to the heart of his bravery.
Well, I mean, that's one of the great things about the film, too, is that as horrifying as so many aspects of the story are, there's so much inspiration in it as well that comes through even with the sadness of what happened in Oxnard back then. And certainly Larry's character glows through in the way that Larry's friends speak about him. There's a lot of inspiration and beauty in the film.
Yeah, and I just felt the kids, you know, a lot of them came out to me who hadn't come out to their parents that are in the film, and Larry was an inspiration for them. You know, like I said, they look back and they regret that they weren't more open to who he was being at the time. But really, when you look at it, it was only 2 weeks. I mean, it was just a blip of time on the radar. I mean, it was really... It's shocking how fast that, you know, it just spun out of control. I mean, it's such a short period of time.
One of the things that you and I discussed in terms of, you know, writing the program notes, and I'm sure this question has come up for you many times, was how does one approach pronouns in a situation like this where,
yes.
Where Larry was called Larry, Larry went by Larry, Larry had not, you know, he was... Larry was 14 years old. And so at what point is it appropriate for people to choose pronouns? And I think that it's something that all of us were very conscious of, and I'm sure you were conscious of, and I'm sure it will come up in the conversations after the film, is how do you, mm-hmm. in a situation where someone hasn't for themselves, you know, declared a pronoun preference, you know, what is the obligation? I don't think there's an easy answer to that.
Right, right.
Yeah, I agree with you. And it's interesting. I was in Utah, and I did a screening there, and someone came up to the mic and said, you know, I would really prefer that everyone in this room start calling Larry Letitia, because that's who he was. He was Letitia, and she deserves that. And from that point on, it was very interesting. The whole room started calling Larry Letitia and using she as a pronoun. It was a very powerful moment. And it's interesting because at this point, I never knew Larry Letitia. I just know that how I feel about it is, you know, as a filmmaker and as a parent, I'm comfortable with both. Neither one of them really has the gravitas that I'm sure if he was alive or she was alive would be able to tell us. But I do think it's really, I think the power lies in being able to kind of fluctuate. And I think that that's what's so great about the children that are in the film. You know, Avery, his best friend, was like, well, I was a lesbian last year, but this year I think I'm bi. And there's this flow, there's this fluidity to their gender identity, to their sexual orientation that my generation did not have. And that, to me, is powerful within itself.
It is.
Like, I don't really, you know, I don't really feel like being a he today. I'm going to be a she, or maybe I'm going to, you know, the day he died, he dressed as a boy again.
Right.
So it's to me, it's about challenging that. You know, why do we have to get so hung up with that? Why do we need to be so clear about that when there are people like Larry Letitia who are just kind of really comfortable with either or?
Right, or fluid.
You know, I mean, why not play with that? And I think that that's fantastic that this generation that he was a part of is challenging the boundaries of gender identity.
Well, it's definitely presented a great opportunity for folks to have a discussion over that, and when is it appropriate, and who do we ask? You know, as a person who identifies as genderqueer and trans in the community, it's definitely something that, you know, I've dealt with before, and people have talked to me about, you know. So yeah, definitely great message. And I wanted to ask you real quick too, because you do look at some of the other side of the story, you know, with Brandon, I think. And I just wanted to ask what insights did you glean from that perspective, from that point of view? Because you look at it from, you know, the point of the killer, you know, the point of the person that did this.
Yeah.
You know.
I think the first place I felt was just absolute rage and anger. When I was sitting in that courtroom, I realized that I was completely looking at him in a very one-dimensional way. And then when I was sitting in the courtroom, I realized there was a kid in front of me. He was 14, and he was pimply and, you know, looked like a 14-year-old. It was peach fuzz. And I started going, okay, I have to see the three-dimensional aspects of this. This is not going to be a fair assessment if I just see him as a white supremacist.
Right.
And who cares what happens to this kid? I really had to take a look at myself as a person, as a believer of equal rights for everyone. And I had to say he's a kid. I had to look at that. And what I realized was, you know, which is in the film, the about amount of abuse and neglect that Brandon went through, the amount of hatred that was existing in this child already, that, you know, one of his mentors, for lack of a better word, was able to kind of ignite. You know, he was surrounded by people who were, at the very least, racist.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're in this kind of hostile environment and you have all of this hatred towards the people who are supposed to be loving you and taking care of you, you know, this is a recipe for disaster. And I really started understanding him as a child and what created him. And it was terrifying. I mean, his mother was a crystal meth addict for years and years and years and years.
Right.
So, you know, we have to take all this in, and we have to understand what, almost from a sociological standpoint, how can we better our living conditions, our school conditions, our communities, for children to grow up safe, including Brandon.
One of the risks in telling a story like this is that it's very easy to fall into a good guy, bad guy scenario and simplifying that. And I think that, again, one of the great strengths of your film is that it does take an intelligent and compassionate look at things that are difficult and painful and, again, in a very compassionate way. So, you know, it's when we're looking at movies for Q-Doc, it's one of the things that we appreciate so much is when filmmakers really do engage with the gray areas of life and don't make polemical films, but make really deep and thoughtful films.
Right. I have to say, I agree. When, you know, initially when I first started, when I screened the film to myself, it was that's the reaction you get, you know, when you see this is good and this is bad and this is what happened, and you start to, I guess, just make these general judgments and assumptions over it. But what the documentary did really well, I think, is highlight that it's not necessarily polemic, and that these are issues, and that we need to look at, you know, all sides of what's going on, what's happening here.
Yeah, and as a humanist, as someone who believes deeply in, you know, equal rights across the board for people, we don't get to choose.
Right.
You know, we don't get to say, oh, well, you know what? You're not human. I'm not going to include you because I have too many issues with your thoughts and your belief system. Like, actually, our country was founded on the exact opposite, and we have to stand by that. If we're going to, I don't agree with the gun laws. I'm a pacifist by nature, but we have to question in order to move forward. We can't just shut the door and preach to the choir. We have to open that door, and we have to start a dialogue. We have to make sure that we're protecting our children in the best way possible, all of them, including Brandon. And when you look at the amount of guns that were in his home and that he had access to these guns, we have to really question, is this world our country is heading towards? Is this okay?
Are we comfortable with this?
Right.
I just want to remind listeners that we are talking about the movie Valentine Road, which is the closing night film of Q-Doc, which is this coming Sunday, May 19th at 7 p.m. at the McMenamins Theater. It's our closing night film of the festival, which starts on Thursday, May 16th with I Am Divine. So we've got from I Am Divine to Valentine Road, everything in between in there. It's a pretty broad range.
Right. And I just wanted to thank you again, Marta, for coming on the show and talking with us about this. And really quick, are there any other, what else is coming up for you? Any other films, any other projects on the horizon?
I'm working on some fiction projects right now. One's romantic comedy. I had to bring some levity. I was down in the dumps with this story for so long. It's just so heartbreaking. And that I was like, you know, maybe it's time for me to do a romantic comedy. So I've been working on a treatment for romantic comedy,
awesome.
Among some other dramas, but all fiction at this point.
Awesome. All right. Well, great. Well, and we look forward to, of course, having you in Portland, and the audience, I think, will get an opportunity to talk with you a little bit more about the film. And discuss it. So,
thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you for coming on the show. Now, David, I wanted to just get back to you really quick and talk a little bit about a couple of the other shows, the other documentaries that are going to be showing.
Okay.
All right. And just maybe go into one or two that we haven't heard about yet.
Well, gosh, there's such a range. I mean, of subject matters that we have. I mean, we have a wonderful film called Wildness that's on Sunday, and Wildness is about a bar in Los Angeles that has been serving the Latino community for a long, long time. It's a family-owned bar, and it sort of became a kind of a drag and trans bar, but very much within the Latino community. And at one point, a whole group of kind of like genderqueer art kids from Silver Lake started doing a club night there one night a week. And the movie is an incredible exploration of how these two worlds start intersecting with each other. And it's a beautiful, wonderful, and story. It's really, really well made. It's a movie called Wildness, and that's playing on Sunday at 2:30 in the afternoon. Big Joy is a film made, co-directed by Eric Slade, who's a Portland filmmaker who actually, I think, was on a different program on KBOO this week. And that's a documentary about a a filmmaker and poet named James Broughton, who was a big advocate of what he called being wild and living a very wild life. And his movies really are very exuberant, and it's a really great film. It's been very, very hot on the festival circuit, and we're excited that Eric Slade, who's local, will be here, and his co-director, Stephen Silla, will both be here with Big Joy, The Adventures of James Broughton, which is at 7 p.m. on Saturday, May 18th.
Awesome. Wonderful. So let me just recap really quick. First of all, for the festival here, how many documentaries are we showing? Got a whole lot.
There's 11 programs. It's a 4-day festival. It's 11 programs, all feature-length films.
Okay.
Starting Thursday, May 16th and ending Sunday, May 19th.
Wonderful. And people can still buy tickets. The best way to do it online?
Tickets are online at our website, which is queerdocfest.org. And you can just Google QDoc or Portland Queer Documentary if you forget that. And I would suggest buying tickets in advance because ticket sales are going pretty fast, and I think we're gonna have a really good turnout this year.
Wonderful. Thank you, David. Thanks again for coming on the show. And remember, youth, kids, free tickets under 23, get out there and watch some free movies. So thanks again, David, for being here with us and talking about QDoc and getting us ready, getting us primed. Thank you, Marta, for your wonderful discussion and your wonderful documentary. We're going to go ahead and switch over to This Way Out for the last half of the program. And so until next week, remember, live proud, live out loud.
Lesbian pro athletes? I think Cheryl Swoopes. What about Billie Jean King? When does she come out?
Martina Navratilova. I think a couple women in the WNBA. I don't know their names.
The general view seems to be that women who play sports are a lot more likely to be lesbian or something.
RCA used to give us enough trouble just about writing outright feminist songs. They sure didn't want us to write gay songs.
Only you can decide. Take the song.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Delaware joins the U.S. Marriage Equality Club, lesbian athletes out since 81, and the deadly nightshade blooms anew. Their stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Robert LeBlanc.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending May 11th, 2013. On December 7th, 1787, Delaware became the first of America's 13 revolutionary colonies to ratify the U.S. Constitution, earning its nickname as the First State. And on May 7th, 2013, Delaware became the 11th U.S. state, along with the District of Columbia, to open civil marriage to gay and lesbian couples. The Delaware House approved a marriage equality measure in April, and by a 12-9 vote on May 7th, the state Senate followed suit. Governor Jack Markell signed the bill into law less than an hour later. He explained that there were a lot of people who have been waiting for years or even decades for something like this to happen. I wasn't going to make them wait any longer. Same-gender couples will still have to wait until July 1st to legally tie the knot in Delaware. The bill reverses the state's 1996 law banning same-gender couples from marrying, upgrades the civil unions that were created there less than 2 years ago to civil marriage, and specifies that recognized relationships from jurisdictions outside Delaware will be treated as marriages under state law. It also guarantees that no religious individual will be forced to officiate at a same-gender couple's wedding. Senator Karen Peterson, who officially came out during debate, told her colleagues that, if my happiness somehow demeans or diminishes your marriage, you need to work on your marriage.
Marriage equality certainly seems to be on a roll in the United States. By the time you hear this newscast, Minnesota could have become the 12th U.S. state with marriage equality. The House approved a measure sponsored by out lesbian representative Karen Clark on May 9th by a 75-59 margin, mostly along party lines. A vote in the Minnesota Senate, which is also controlled by Democrats, was scheduled to take place as early as May 13th. Governor Mark Dayton promised to sign a marriage equality bill if it reached his desk. Minnesota voters rejected a proposed constitutional amendment last November that would have defined marriage as exclusively heterosexual. Meanwhile, Illinois Governor Pat Quinn is calling for a vote on a marriage equality bill in the state house. The measure has been stalled there since it passed in the Senate on Valentine's Day. Quinn told reporters late last week that, "I believe a majority exists to get this bill passed through the House onto my desk so I can sign it into law."
Andrew Lansley, the leader of Britain's House of Commons, told members of Parliament this week that the UK marriage same-sex couples bill will be debated on May 20th and 21st. It will be the measure's third and final reading. A 225-vote majority approved the second reading in February. A committee then studied each provision of the bill. 15 of the 19 members approved all of them in a vote on March 12th. If the bill wins final passage in the House of Commons, it would go next to the House of Lords to begin a similar multi-stage process. If it passes there, both chambers would need to reconcile differences in their respective bills before a final version is sent to Queen Elizabeth II to formally make marriage equality the law of the land in England and Wales. Its proponents predict that wedding bells for lesbian and gay couples could begin ringing there sometime this summer. Scotland's parliament is also expected to consider a marriage equality bill around that same time. Northern Ireland's National Assembly soundly defeated a similar proposal last week.
Members of Australia's Greens, the only party down under to support marriage equality, are pushing for another vote on the issue ahead of general elections in September. Parliament defeated a bill to open civil marriage to same-gender couples by a vote of 98-42 last September. Public opinion surveys consistently show overwhelming support for marriage equality in Australia. Greens MP and Deputy Leader Adam Bandt said that he wants another vote on June 6th and told reporters that it will ensure every MP's position is clear before the election. Uruguay, New Zealand, and France have each opened civil marriage to same-gender couples so far this year.
More than 35,000 people, however, have signed a petition opposing marriage equality in the Baltic nation of Estonia. The Foundation for the Protection of Family and Tradition gathered the signatures and says it will submit them to Parliament later this month to discourage any government proposals to legally recognize same-gender couples. When the Foundation launched the petition drive in March, it set a goal of 10,000 signatures, so its organizers expressed surprise that they got more than triple that amount. A leading Estonian intellectual called last month for the legal recognition of lesbian and gay couples. But a member of Estonia's main conservative political party told reporters soon thereafter that gay people are sick and deviant individuals who like it with animals. The former Soviet satellite is among 10 member states in the European Union that still refuse to provide any legal recognition to same-gender couples.
But a historic hate crimes bill passed this week in the Albanian parliament. Lawmakers amended the Balkan nation's criminal code to put hate crimes based on sexual orientation or gender identity on par with gender, race, color, ethnicity, language, political opinions, religious or philosophical beliefs, health status, genetic predisposition, or disability. The amended criminal code now enhances penalties for convictions of offenses committed against people based on any of those categories. Parliament in the predominantly Muslim nation also passed a new law punishing the dissemination of homophobic information through any means, including the internet, with a fine and up to 2 years in prison. Gaystar News reported that the landmark legislation was developed through a collaboration of Albania's LGBT organizations, Ministry of Justice, and the country's ombudsman, who hailed the laws as a revolution that put Albania in the forefront of the region on the issue. Some radical Islamic groups, who've used more than 30 Facebook pages to recommend ways to kill gay people, voiced their objection to the new laws. The website of the ombudsman was hacked by a group identifying itself as the Islamic Ghost Team.
And the persecution of a gay couple in the predominantly Christian Southern African nation of Zambia continues. Phil Mumbiana and James Mumwasa, each 21 years old, were arrested in Nyendeke village in rural Zambia this week on charges of having sex against the order of nature. According to Amnesty International, they're the same two men who were arrested on the same charges in late April and released on bail on May 2nd. The Global Human Rights Group said that one of the men's neighbors reported them to police, leading to their rearrests on May 6th. The detained men reportedly have low literacy levels and a poor understanding of the Zambian legal system or their personal rights. The men were apparently held in an overcrowded cell without water or food for their first 12 hours behind bars. They were each subjected to scientifically discredited anal examinations to supposedly determine whether or not they had had sex with each other, and may have also been forced to make confessions to speed up the trial. Their next court appearance is scheduled for May 22nd.
Elsewhere, demonstrators were scheduled to gather outside an Auckland, New Zealand branch of global fast food giant McDonald's late this week to protest the treatment of a staff member who was told by his manager that he would be disciplined if he turned anybody else on the shift gay or acted gay during his shift. Sean Bailey said he had to call in sick just because I couldn't work with him, which meant I lost work hours and money. Demonstrators during the Turn McDonald's Gay Day planned to hold a kiss-in inside the restaurant and what organizers called a gay disco experience outside on the picket line. A spokesperson for McDonald's said that the company takes complaints of this nature very seriously. In this specific case, the restaurant followed internal processes, but due to privacy restrictions, we cannot discuss the outcome. According to Bailey, the manager was just transferred to another location, and he worries that there's nothing to stop him from doing the same thing somewhere else.
And finally, do you remember hearing about Roads Minister Duncan Gay in the Australian state of New South Wales? He was strongly criticized last month for removing Sydney's Rainbow Crossing, which had been painted on an intersection in the city's predominantly gay business district as part of the world-famous Mardi Gras celebration. Gay claimed that safety concerns prompted the removal. And wearing a rainbow tie, he made a surprise appearance in Sydney this week at the annual Glorias, the Gay and Lesbian Outrageous, Ridiculous, and Ignorant Comment Awards. The dubious distinctions have been awarded since 2010. Gay picked up a trophy following a boo-off at the ceremony. All the other winners won their categories through online voting. Conservative Herald Sun columnist Andrew Bolt captured the Media Category Award for writing that lesbians and gay men already have marriage equality because they're free to marry people of the opposite sex. Right-wing United Kingdom politician John Sullivan was among the international winners. His Facebook page likened LGBT activists to termites. And in the religion category, American Southern Baptist Convention President Reverend Fred Luter won a Gloria for linking marriage equality and LGBT rights to North Korea's recent nuclear threats.
That's News Wrap for the week ending May 11th, 2013. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and produced by Steve Pride.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep This Way Out on the air at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Robert LeBlanc.
High-flying women return now that the lovers are winning. Later in the program. What have lesbian pro athletes been doing since 1981 that gay male athletes have not? This Way Out correspondent Michelle Marie Gilkison hit the streets to get the score.
On April 29, 2013, pro basketball player Jason Collins came out as gay in an open letter to be published in Sports Illustrated magazine. The 12-year NBA veteran wrote, I didn't set out to be the first openly gay athlete playing in a major American team sport. But since I am, I'm happy to start the conversation. I wish I wasn't the kid in the classroom raising his hand and saying, I'm different. If I had my way, someone else would have already done this. Nobody has, which is why I'm raising my hand. The thing is, many women pro athletes have come out while playing their sports. Over a dozen tennis, basketball, soccer, golf, and volleyball players came out as lesbians between 1981 and 2013. In fact, WNBA star Brittany Griner openly discussed her sexuality with the media a few weeks before Collins released his coming out letter. As one ESPN reporter put it, Griner's acknowledging she's gay had the impact of a feather hitting the ground. Have you heard anything about the coming out of pro basketball player Jason Collins this week?
I heard a little bit about it, yeah. I think it's great that he came out. I think it showed a lot of bravery on his part, and yeah, I think it was a good decision.
I'm happy that he did. Support him and hope the rest of the NBA and fans do as well.
I don't really follow basketball, you said? I don't really follow basketball. I suppose it's part of a national trend of famous people coming out, and I guess once a certain number of people start doing it, you know, it encourages other people to do it as well.
I think it's great. I think it's about time. I think that more athletes will come out now. And I think that if all the athletes who are gay came out, it would change a lot. So I'm all for it. And I'm going to start watching him play. I hate basketball, but I'm going to start watching basketball now.
I've never heard of Jason Collins before. I'm sorry.
I think it's great. I support it. I support all of it.
Are you aware of any women athletes who've come out in the past as lesbian?
Actually, no.
I think so. I don't know them off the top of my head, but yeah.
No, actually, I'm not aware of any.
Martina Navratilova. I think a couple women in the WNBA. I don't know their names. Who else? And that was about it.
Lesbian pro athletes? I think Cheryl Swoops. What about Billie Jean King? When did she come out?
1981.
That was 81?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Can you tell me your name and where you're from?
Matthew from San Rafael.
What do you think about the coverage that the Jason Collins story has gotten compared to the at least 16 lesbians who've come out since 1981?
Yeah, I guess now that you mention it, I saw like 6 articles or something on like the Jason Collins one on Yahoo, which did seem a bit excessive. Yeah, that's interesting.
Do you have any thoughts about why that coverage disparity might be that way?
I don't know. I guess maybe part of it would be, in general, like the NBA is more in the public's view, more in the public's eye than the WNBA. I don't think I could name any like WNBA players, although I also wouldn't have been able to name him before he came out. For one thing, I think just like not my view, but like the general view seems to be that women who play sports are a lot more likely to be lesbian or something. Like, I know that's the view in like the LPGA. Maybe that's why it's so much more shocking when a guy comes out. Yeah.
Ariel Carpenter, North Carolina. I go to CGU. There's probably no media attention for it, but I think that's how, in comparison from NBA to WNBA, I would expect that. I think for most Americans, when they think of female athletes, they don't think of femininity. So I think that's part of the issues at hand.
My name is Amanda Nonamer, and I'm from Arizona, from Claremont Graduate University. I think particularly currently there's a shifting paradigm of what is masculine and what is feminine, and there's certainly a lot of confusion within that. And so I think that people try to take sides and try to really develop an opinion and like take a stronger side than they may need to or may have in the past.
My name is Ian Hosang. I'm from Kingston, Jamaica. I am a senior at Pomona College studying economics. You know, I wasn't aware of that discrepancy, but maybe it could be because of I think people are more in general accepting of lesbians and gay men. So maybe that's a part of the reason. It could also be a part of the reason, the fact that men's sports are a lot more popular in terms of viewers and in terms of sports fans. So maybe the reaction is just greater because the basketball player is more popular, and men's basketball and men's sports is more popular.
Maureen, Studio City. I think it might have gotten, it might be getting less coverage because, you know, back then, you know, when Martina Navratilova came out, it was kind of a huge thing, and, you know, people were becoming more and more accepting of gay and lesbian people. So I think that the Jason Collins thing with the 24-hour news cycle, I think it just kind of flew by. I know an ESPN commentator made a very homophobic remark, and he said that, well, he can't be a Christian because he's gay, and there was some big thing over that. I think we expect male athletes to be macho and to be straight and to be strong, and people need to realize that there's gay men are some of the most macho men out there.
My name is Andrea, and I'm from Washington, D.C. I definitely think, I mean, we even discussed this in one of my sociology class, but I definitely think female athletes are, like, made more masculine. In that case, it's, like, less surprising. I don't know. It's like the stereotypes being repeated.
My name is Muriel, and I'm from Illinois. I mean, I just think it's a double standard because athleticism in general is associated with masculinity. So I guess being a homosexual is associated with femininity. So I think that's why it's harder for males to come out and feel comfortable as opposed to women, where it's more accepted for them to exert power through their sexuality like that.
My name is James McNulty. I'm from West Los Angeles. I think times have changed a little bit too, don't you think? 1980, I mean, it was a pretty unprecedented thing there for a female to come out like that. But, I mean, people are more accepting these days. I think they're a little tougher on the males. I think because in sports, it's a masculine thing, it's a manly thing, and a lot of times we don't associate that with homosexuality. I mean, I was in the Marine Corps, and we had a few gay officers who never were able to come out, but were great leaders and great role models. So I've seen it in different areas. Yeah, I think this will really get things rolling. That's my opinion.
For This Way Out, this is Michelle Marie Gildison.
Hi, this is Janice Ian, and you're listening to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. Support your local public radio station. You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
Thirty-eight years between albums? Not many bands live to see the day. Queer music heritage historian extraordinaire J.D. Doyle profiles this trailblazing comeback act then and now.
From 1975, the band The Deadly Nightshade is about to encourage you to keep on the sunny side.
There's a dark and a troubled side of life. There's a bright and a sunny side too.
The band called The Deadly Nightshade formed in the early 1970s and were among the very first all-female bands signed to a major record label. They were the first of those bands whose music came from a feminist perspective. The members were Pam Brandt, Helen Hook, and Ann Bowen, and I'm pleased to share with you part of an interview I did with Pam. They had two LPs in 1975 and 1976, and now, 36 years later, have just released a new CD. But before we get to that, I wanted to hear about one of the band's early feminist songs. And from their first album, one of their best known and most anthemic ones was called High Flying Woman. That song's words had a message.
Well, words were very important to feminists back in those days. Well, like the word chick, you were all supposed to be a woman, not a girl if you were over a certain age. Chick was one of those words, which we really hated because, you know, as band people, it was okay for women to be in bands if they were just the chick singer for a male band. And, you know, what was considered inappropriate was for women to actually be the band, be the players. So the whole chick thing really rubbed us wrong. So that's what the whole song originally started out as. You're not a chick. You're a free-flying woman, a high-flying woman. You should set yourself free, take yourself for a glide. You're a high-flying woman.
Did you ever think that you lived in a cage? Did you ever think that you lived in a cage? Well, they're calling you a chick, and the name just seems to and you still don't think you're living in a cage. Have you heard? Have you heard? There's a migration happening, going where the thinking is free. Only you can decide. Take yourself for a ride. You're a free-flying woman, a high-flying woman.
With much hindsight, and acknowledging that the early 70s were very different times, how closeted would you say the band was?
Too closeted. Closeted enough that I rapidly grew ashamed of it. It was what was done at the time. I mean, there were real reasons in the mainstream music industry. RCA used to give us enough trouble just about writing outright feminist songs. They sure didn't want us to write gay songs.
I know the history of Deadly Nightshade is not over, but what do you consider your place in music history?
Well, we were not the first all-female band, which some people seem to think we were. But the Deadly Nightshade was the only all-female band signed to a mainstream major record label that recorded songs with explicit, outright feminist content, subject matter. And so I think that was important. And we were one of the first female bands. For us back in the day, it was considered inappropriate for young women like us, like we were then, to play in loud electric bands. Now, many more young women are playing in bands, thank heaven. But it's still considered inappropriate for old ladies to play in loud electric bands. So that's really sort of like another reason we got back together, we thought. Seems like it's time for us to have some more fun. And, you know, back then we behaved inappropriately. Now we're behaving inappropriately for different reasons. And I hope that we continue just sort of breaking down doors for the rest of our lives.
I mentioned that the new CD was their first in 36 years, so I wanted to hear about it.
It's a mix, like in the old days, of silly songs and serious songs, and of songs that are political and songs that are not explicitly political. And then there are 5 songs that are audio and video from the old days of the Deadly Nightshade.
The new CD is called Never Ever Gonna Stop, and I think they mean it. And one of those political songs from it is called Don't the Lovers Ever Win. And that song is also a first for them.
Right. That's actually the first song with outright gay subject matter that the Deadly Nightshade ever wrote or performed or recorded. It's a song about gay rights and the people who want to foil those, the oppressors and the homophobes. So the song was supposed to be gently ironic. Don't the Lovers Ever Win. It points out these things that people are trying to do to us and just ask the question, don't the lovers ever win?
You can find out more about the band at www.thedeadlynightshade.net and hear the rest of my interview with Pam Brandt at queermusicheritage.com. This is J.D. Doyle, and you are listening to This Way Out.
Ever since it all.
Who was Harry Smith? To musicians, he was the man who created the Anthology of Folk Music in 1954. It set fire to the folk music movement of the 60s and inspired everyone from Bob Dylan to the Grateful Dead. To filmmakers, he was the man who made animation in the 40s by painting directly on film and who was in the middle of the avant-garde film movement of the 60s with Jack Smith, Andy Warhol, and the Kuchar brothers. Harry was a product of the Pacific Northwest, born here in Portland, and this Thursday, May 16th, the Oregon Cartoon Institute proudly presents the Harry Smith Seance at the Hollywood Theater, with live music and 3 projectors showing Harry's heaven and earth magic. That's this Thursday, May 16th, 7 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater. And on Sunday, May 19th, it's the Harry Smith Free-for-All. All afternoon this Sunday, absolutely free, downtown at the Ace Cleaners, co-sponsored by KBOO. More information at harrysmith.com. pdx.wordpress.com.
For your names you took hope and humble, black and tan. Your whipped wind of change howled low, blowing itself smack in the middle of Ellington's orchestra. Billy heard it too and cried strange fruit tears. Your resistance was found in the food that you placed at the master's table. Ha.
Born and raised in Portland, Oregon, the internationally renowned visual artist Carrie Mae Weems is known for her art investigating issues of race, class, and gender. Her show at the Portland Art Museum ends this Sunday. Tune in to KABU on Friday morning at 11 a.m. to hear a talk she gave at the opening of the exhibition in February. That's Carrie Mae Weems, this Friday, May 17th, from 11 a.m. to noon on KABU. More information can be found on the website kboo.fm/Carrie Mae Weems.
Good evening. The time is 7:05. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Hard Knock Radio. Stay tuned.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
What's up, fam? You're tuned to Hard Knock Radio here on the Pacifica Network. On today's program, Davey D speaks with writer and MC Homeboy Sandman about an article he wrote that explores Viacom's ownership in private prison industries, as well as the way in which folks need to organize to address these ills. I'm Anita Johnson. All this and more ahead, so keep it locked.